We'll call a meeting to order. We do have a quorum present. Representative Johnson will move the minutes of the March 10, 2009 meeting. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, those minutes are approved. The first bill up is House File 925. Representative Dabney will move that the committee, or move the committee report on House File 925 be adopted. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Representative Dabney will then move that House File 925 be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Committee on Higher Education, Workforce Development, Finance, and Policy. Representative Surge, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to be back this year. Mr. Chair and members, I have a bill dealing with the unemployment rate. Members, right now within existing state statutes, the only process that DEED has to go through is to provide current state and sub-state labor market information and forecasts in cooperation with other agencies. Members, right now, the department uses the U3 rate. There are six different rates to recognizing unemployment. And right now, the U3 rate is used, and basically, in a nutshell, that is the rate of those collecting unemployment insurance and a few others. There is a more broad measure to measure unemployment because no single statistic reflects the labor market difficulties with unemployment. A U6 rate, which I'm proposing that the state develop, looks at the total unemployed persons plus those who are employed but are working fewer hours than they would like, and the discouraged workers who are looking for work recently and have expressed interest in working. Members, I've handed out in your packets an article from the Wall Street Journal fairly recently, and this basically states that we'd have a more accurate, I believe, and a broad representation of who is unemployed. Sadly, if we use a more broad rate, the unemployment rate would almost double, but I think we'd be more accurate, and I think that would be good in two ways. Number one, we'd get a better sense of what the labor market truly is, and number two, for our state resources, we'd have a better sense of who is unemployed, why they're unemployed, and we'd be able to, I think, more strategically use our state resources in workforce development and retraining. So I worked with Steve Hine, who's provided great information for me and background from DEED, and he's also here to answer any questions. If not, I'm open for questions too, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Surdich. And I think since it's been through the division and came out of there swimmingly, we'll probably hold off on testimony unless there's a need for just to answer any questions that may arise. But I should ask, is there anyone else who desires to testify with respect to the bill? Are there any questions or concerns from members of the committee? Representative Anderson and Representative Murdoch. Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Surdich, help me figure out, how would they go about, I was looking at line 114, and impediments to work, including lack of child care or transportation. I mean, what are the requirements as far as determining that? Do you see what I'm saying? Because, you know, child care, it might be an issue that they just don't want to pay that much, and that's why they're not working, or they maybe don't want to take the bus or take their car. I mean, how is that going to be defined? Is that somewhere defined already, or how does that work?
Representative
Surdich? Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the Bureau of Labor Statistics monthly gets surveys, and all of this information is provided. This data is already collected by the federal government and the Department of Labor and the Bureau of Labor Statistics. It would just allow DEED to manipulate this data and give it to us in this U6 fashion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
So when the Bureau does these surveys, I mean, what is their criteria of what is not having child care available? Just because the individual in the survey says, well, I don't have child care, or do they actually look to see if there's actual child care available, and they're just choosing not to use it?
Mr. Chair, if we're getting into the particulars of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, it's time to bring in the experts, so I'd like Mr. Hines to join me here at the table.
Mr. Hines, if you just identify yourself and proceed to answer the question.
And Mr. Chair, I got through one question, which is better than Representative Dabney's committee, so I'm improving along the way.
We were all very impressed, Representative Surge.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Dabney.
We did have the opportunity to place stump the majority leader in my division on Wednesday, and I'm sorry we're not taking a chance to do it again here today.
Well, I know we had a list of about 35 questions, mm-hmm. but we're probably going to back off on a few of those. So, Mr. Hines, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee. Thank you, Representative Surdich. And thank you, Representative Anderson, for the question. The answer is somewhat unspecific. The question does ask, we back up. This is a household survey asking people whether they have work, if not whether they have actively sought work. And if they say no to that, then questions are asked about why not. And they are simply asked to respond whether it's a child care constraint, transportation issue, discouragement over potential job prospects, or other explanations. So there's not much pursuit as to whether the reason for child care, for example, being an impediment to working is because of cost or availability. But it is indicated that that is their particular explanation for why they aren't working.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Murdoch, you had a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Either of you can probably answer this. Down the road, will this rate of unemployment take my unemployment rates up, my unemployment insurance rates up down the road for my small business?
I'm going with Mr. Hines on this one. Mr. Hines?
Thank you, Representative Murdoch. The unemployment rate that's calculated from this household survey isn't directly related to the eligibility or ineligibility of unemployment insurance. The respondents are not asked to identify whether they're collecting benefits. There are situations in which an unemployed person may not be eligible for benefits. There are situations in which beneficiaries are not considered to be unemployed. So they overlap, and we do use the unemployment insurance data in the modeling exercise that estimates the Q3 that Representative Sertich mentioned, and would be part of the process, I would imagine, that would be developed here to estimate U6. But there isn't a direct relationship between eligibility for unemployment benefits and being counted as unemployed for this purpose.
Representative Sertich, you have a supplement to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Murdoch, this would have no impact on your business financially. This would just, this is data collected by the federal government that we'd be able to put in the formats which will better help us in serving this population.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Sertich, maybe you just answered this, and I wasn't catching it because I was asking some questions here. So this is not going to establish what the new, how we award UI benefits, and it's not changing how we do that, or it is?
Representative Sertich.
Mr. Chair, Ben Anderson, in no way will it be doing that. We are certainly, all we're doing is gathering information and reporting information to the public through deed that will more accurately represent how many folks are unemployed. It has nothing to do with unemployment insurance. Unemployment insurance is only one factor of measuring the U3 data right now, and as Mr. Hines said, that data would be incorporated in U6, as U6 is a more broad measurement or a broad tool to see this, but in no way would it deal with eligibility standards or any other financial payments.
Okay.
Thank you. There being no further questions, Representative Dabney renews his motion that House File 925 be recommended, passed, and referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Thank you, Representative Sertich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hines, as well. Next up is House File 475, Representative Winkler's bill. The chair will move that House File 475 be recommended, passed, and referred to the Committee on Tax. Representative Winkler, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think maybe the third time I've ever been here. Not the last, I hope. You do have in your package, I think, a blue folder that looks like this with a lot of, I think, useful information about what this Small Business Investment Act does. Economically, right now, of course, we're having troubles globally. But in Minnesota, we have a broader problem, which is that for the first time in a generation, our economy is underperforming the nation starting in 2006. Economists point to one crucial factor for that troubling change, which is that Minnesota has fewer new companies forming and growing than other states, which means that we are not as nimble and able to change when the national economy changes. Crucial component of that is access to capital. You have in your packets a sheet that looks like this, and it describes the funding levels and stages for companies. This is one of two bills or initiatives this year that's coming back to deal with early stage investment capital. Essentially, the program creates a tax credit that is created starting in 2013. that will go to insurance companies. In exchange, insurance companies will invest a portion of their reserves into venture capital funds that will invest in Minnesota businesses, small Minnesota businesses, and with potential to grow. This does not change the risk portfolio of those reserve funds because those are already tightly regulated by the State Department of Commerce. They have ratios for risk in their portfolio. So this does nothing with that. All it says, all it does is create a credit for those reserves to be invested in small businesses in Minnesota as opposed to businesses in other places. This is a proven tool that's been successfully done in other states. Missouri has done up this three times, Texas twice, Wisconsin is in the middle of doing it now, and New York has done it a couple of times. I think this is crucial now more than ever, and we actually have a venture capitalist in the audience over here who would like nothing more than to...
What do they look like?
They always have pocket squares, Mr. Chair. They want to put Minnesotans to work, and they want to invest in Minnesota companies, and this is a tool that would enable them to do so.
Thank you, Representative Winkler. And I'm not sure what your reception in the Tax Committee, where tax credits are not quite as acceptable these days, but
this is in the governor's budget, and the Senate really likes it, so we hope that changes the conversation.
That's two-thirds of the stool, but from a commerce and labor perspective, business and jobs, I think it's going to be well-received in this committee. Are there questions or concerns that members have, or anyone else who desires to testify? Otherwise, the chair will renew his motion that House File 475 be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Taxes. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Thank you, Representative Winkler.
Thank
Good luck in the Tax Committee. Next up is, wow, what a, that's amazing. Representative Dabney will move that, let me make sure that, did this one come out of the...
This came out of my division.
Out of the division. So Representative Dabney will move the committee report on House File 1116 be adopted. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Representative Dabney will next move that House File 1116 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. And apparently we don't make recommended re-referrals, but we'd kind of like it to go to higher ed, I guess, higher ed finance. But we'll just send it off to finance. Representative Dabney, it's my understanding there's two author's amendments. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Can you move those amendments for us, please?
If I could move the A090127 amendment.
And that is the amendment to put the bill in the shape with which the author would like to proceed. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none. Next up, Representative Dabney.
I'd like to move the A090110 amendment.
And again, that's an author's amendment to put it in the shape with which the author would like to proceed. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Dabney, your bill.
House File 1116 is a policy and housekeeping bill brought forward by the Department of Employment and Economic Development. The bill has four articles. Article 1 is deed policy and includes several small policy issues. Article 2 is deed housekeeping language, and Chuck Hamilton will describe those sections in as much detail as the body wishes. Articles 3 or 4 are products of the UI, the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council, which is a council made up of legislators, business, labor, chamber, National Federation of Independent Businesses, and others. These articles have minor policy and housekeeping changes in them, and Mr. Nelson is here to describe those. At this point, Mr. Chair, I'd like to hand it over to Mr. Hamilton to discuss the first two articles.
And thank you, Representative Dabney. This got a full hearing in the division,
yes,
that right?
Yes, it did.
And let me ask this question. Is there anyone here to testify in opposition to the bill? Is there anyone on the committee that has questions or concerns with respect to the bill? Let's see if we can target those, and we'll see if we need a fuller explanation. Representative Hoppe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's an easy, quick question for Representative Dabney. On looking at the bill, lines 2.2 and 2.3, when we're adding to the local government unit definitions, public higher education institution, and then under that Board of Regents, is there a particular specific reason why that was done? Can you enlighten me on that one?
And Representative Dabney, who would we look to with respect to that?
I'm Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe. I'm told this relates to the Bio-Business Infrastructure Act.
Yes. Okay.
Representative Hoppe, satisfied?
Perfect.
Anyone else that has questions or concerns with respect to the bill? Representative Dabney then renews his motion.
Mr. Chair?
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Murdoch. I looked away just at the wrong time. Representative Murdoch.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have an amendment, the 116A1 amendment. Do I have to move it, or what do I have to do with this?
I will consider it moved if you want to then explain what your amendment would do, and we'll take it from there.
What these two little things here will do is deals with the 401K, and it will allow the use of the 401K upon enactment of this bill instead of the start date of August 2nd. So it will allow people to use their 401K, which is considered income, use that up first, and then if they haven't found a job by then, be able to draw unemployment sooner. So that's about it.
Thank you, Representative Murdoch, and I apologize because I had it sitting right here in front of me, your very amendment. And unfortunately, Mr. Representative Dabney, do you have a reaction to that?
Two thumbs up, and I appreciate Representative Murdoch.
For those listening to the tape recording.
Yeah, there we go. I appreciate Representative Murdoch bringing this to me earlier in the day. He also checked in with the department, and my understanding is that they are comfortable with it as well.
Very good. All in favor, then, of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, the motion carries. Are there any other questions or concerns with respect to the bill? Seeing none, Representative Dabney then will renew his motion that House File 1116 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Committee on Higher Ed and Workforce Development, Finance and Policy. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails.
Thank you,
Representative Dabney. Next up we have House File 354, Representative Hillstrom's bill. The Representative Dabney will move that the committee report on House File 354 be adopted. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Representative Dabney will next move that House File 354 be recommended pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. Representative Hillstrom, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House and members, House File 354 is known as the Homeowner Lender Mediation Act. And this is mandatory mediation prior to foreclosure. The economy, as you know, the economy is reeling and that it will not recover until we deal with this foreclosure crisis. It has destabilized home values, shaken our communities, and hurt Minnesota families. 20% of the economy is made up of housing, the housing sector. And so by 2010, it is estimated that $70 billion in home values will be lost. We are projecting that an increase of 30,000 new foreclosures will take place in 2009, and this act is designed to start to stabilize the housing section of our economy. This is modeled after the successful Farmer Lender Mediation Act that was adopted by this legislature in 1986. And Mr. Chair, there are some folks that will be here to testify that they have some concerns, and I just want to assure the committee that we are working and still talking. And I commit to work on the relationship between the counseling and the mediation section in this bill. Currently, the timing of the counseling is being worked on, and it is our intent for the majority of the mediation to take place between the time of the advertisement for foreclosure and the sheriff's sale, and I will attempt to get language that can make that timing work.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. I see you have a friend sitting nearby.
I do. With me is Kermit Fritke from the Attorney General's office.
Welcome, Mr. Fritke. If you'd just identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Kermit Fritke. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Office of Attorney General Lori Swanson. I'm here testifying today in support of this bill on behalf of the Attorney General. Minnesota, like the rest of the nation, is facing one of the greatest economic and social challenges of our lifetime. The foreclosure crisis is not only affecting those Minnesotans who are losing their homes, but it touches their friends, neighbors, and in many parts of the state, entire communities. In many cases, a homeowner may fall behind on their mortgage, but still have the means to cure the default and even remain in the home. Unfortunately, given the explosion of mortgage securitizations over the last decade, it is difficult, if not impossible, to reach someone at the mortgage servicer who has the authority to work out that default. Mandatory mediation would help solve this problem. Mediation is a tool that has been used successfully to resolve disputes in many other situations. Mediation, like foreclosure prevention counseling, is another tool to help stabilize home values and stop foreclosures that can be prevented. This bill will not only help homeowners facing foreclosure, but their friends and neighbors who have seen their own property values fall as a result of the crisis. Unlike many of the recently announced federal programs, mediation applies to all home mortgages. The bill does not require a lender to modify their mortgage. It just requires them to come to the table to determine if the home can be saved. In some cases, that will not be possible. However, in many others, mediation will allow the parties to reach an agreement and avoid the tragic consequences of foreclosure.
Thank you, Mr. Fricke.
You're welcome.
I have a number of other, a handful of other folks that desire to testify. I've got Mr. Hines, Mr. Witt, Ms. Humphrey, and Mr. Skillbred. Representative Davis?
Mr. Chairman, to the witness, you mentioned in your comments that this one worked for everybody and some it would not be possible to save them. Do they still, if it's just plain not possible that it's going to be saved, do we still have to wait the extra 100 days?
No, if it's
Mr.
not
possible. Oh,
sorry, Mr.
You'll get used to it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, the mediator has the authority to declare that there's no possible way that this house can be saved, and they can end the mediation by providing a mediation closure statement. So that will happen long before the 90 days runs.
Representative Davis?
Mr. Chairman, to the witness, who's doing the mediating? Who's the mediator?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the mediators are appointed by the Attorney General's office, or the parties can decide on their own mediator.
Mr. Chairman, to the witness, how does this match up with what Obama has done to this point?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Davis, the Obama plan that was recently announced has two components, one of which allows people to refinance their mortgage if they either have some value in their home or slightly underwater, and those are Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac mortgages that have to be either held or securitized by that mortgage. The second part of the federal plan that was announced last week is a voluntary modification program. Lenders that have received federal TARP bailout money, if they receive some more in the future, they will have to comply and have to agree to consider modifying mortgages. But right now, there's no requirement for those lenders to do that.
Thank you. Representative, thank you. And Mr. Hines and Mr. Witt, if you guys want to...
I'm not Mr. Hines, I'm here.
Okay, well, come on down. That's good enough. Are you more articulate than Mr. Hines? Are you more articulate than Mr. Hines?
From the few times I've met him, I would say no.
It's a very kind answer for Mr. Hines. Welcome to the committee. If you'll just identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
My name is John Dorgan. I'm an attorney in Minneapolis. I'm a member of the Community Association Institute, which is an organization, a national organization that works for the benefit of community associations, which are condominiums, townhomes, those organizations. There's a state chapter in almost every state, and there are regional chapters. I'm here today to comment on the applicability section of this proposed bill, because we believe at CAI that the applicability is too broad in that it applies to community association lien foreclosures, and we don't believe it should. The bill is written for mortgage foreclosures and not an association foreclosure, which is a completely separate animal, other than that an association foreclosure is conducted pursuant to the mortgage foreclosure statute. That's mainly why I'm here. I've stated my point. The Senate has a similar bill that now contains an engrossment that has reduced the applicability section. I'm not in full favor of that engrossment, but I would endorse it comparing to the applicability section we have here. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Dorgan. I think what we'll do is we'll take the testimony in opposition or that has concerns about the bill, and then we'll open it up for questions for those folks or for the Attorney General and Representative Hillstrom as well. Thank you, Mr. Dorgan. Mr. Skillbred, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is David Skillbred. I'm the Vice President of Government Relations for the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota, the statewide association of smaller, privately held community banks throughout the state, but mostly in rural Minnesota. The first point I'd like to make on this bill is that we do not believe community bankers are the target of the bill. When you ask proponents who are the target or what is the purpose, they will say to get people in the room, to foster better communication, etc. if you think of the community bankers that you know that they are tied to a geography. They live and work with the customers that they serve. They are in the room. They are always available, and they will go beyond any program mandated in order to avoid foreclosure, because that's what they do. Our greatest concern about this bill is the assumption, and the assumption is that the farmer lender model is a template for our housing challenges. We don't believe that that's true. The comparing farm loans of the 80s to home loans of today is our apples and oranges comparison. Further, it duplicates the counseling law that we passed last year, which just became effective. I appreciate the author's comment on that, that we'll work through the details, but it's still unclear to me what the purpose of the mediator is compared to the purpose of the counselor. But here are some huge differences that I hope you keep in mind as you consider this bill. The differences between farm loans and home loans. For those of you in the ag community, you know this. Generally speaking, there are four basic varieties of farm loans. Operating loans, machinery loans, livestock loans, and ag real estate loans. Operating loans are typically 1 year, sometimes renewable for 2 or 3 years. You take them out at the early part of the calendar year, you get your crops in, you pay them off, and you get your crops out. 1 year terms. Machinery and livestock loans, generally 5 to 7 year terms. Ag real estate, 10 to 20 year terms. Very different term rates than home loans. Secondly, farms are not only homes, but they're businesses. As a result of that, farmers have complex revenue, complex expenditure streams. Financial analysts in the Farmer Lender Mediation Program help farmers put those budget numbers together, and those assets, those properties, those expanded revenue and expenditure streams provide mediators, borrowers, and lenders a lot of opportunities for mediation. Homeowners, on the other hand, typically are going to be confined to 1 or 2 W-2s. So the question is, how are you going to mediate in the homeowner example compared to the farmer lender example? And secondly, mediation, of course, assumes two parties going towards the middle for a compromise. A farmer might sell off a little land, property, sell machinery, rent machinery, sell livestock, sell crops. That'll produce money to help pay down the debt. The lender then comes on the other side with something. On the homeowner side, the question is, are we going to ask homeowners to cancel their Comcast contract, cancel their Verizon contract in order to bring their expenditure level down to free up money on the borrowing side for the mortgage? It's much simpler, but options just don't exist. ICDM and a lot of other organizations supported the counseling provision last year. We believe that's operating very, very well. And again, I just hope that you would think seriously about the relationship between the counselor and the mediator, and secondly, what the goal of the mediator is and the outcome desired if you pursue with this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Skilbred. And I see Ms. Humphrey next to you, or Mr. Witt, who wants to, in the order, we've got Mr. Witt up next, and then Ms. Humphrey. So, Mr. Witt, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Joe Witt. I'm CEO of the Minnesota Bankers Association. We represent 96% of the Minnesota banks. All our member banks have a brick-and-mortar presence and commitment here in Minnesota. I do not represent any out-of-state servicers like the one that we heard about earlier in the testimony. I don't represent the huge insurance companies and the investment houses that hold mortgages and that hold securitized pools. I work for the Minnesota banks. The MBA and our bankers are very much support good communication between borrowers and lenders. Our banks are very good at that. We also very much want to reduce the number of preventable mortgages. We think that's a very good goal, and we think that's a very worthy goal and appreciate that very much. We've had a relationship with the Minnesota Home Ownership Center for the past 5 years. We've tried to work in concert with them to reduce those foreclosures. Having said that, we do have some concerns with this bill, and we currently do oppose it, but we very much appreciate that the author has been willing to work with us and has been willing to listen to our concerns. Our concerns fall into two main categories. The first one is the scope of the bill, that it would apply to all mortgage foreclosures in the state of Minnesota. We believe that's too broad, especially given the fact that the Obama administration has come out with their plan. And we did put a summary of that plan in your packet of materials if you haven't had a chance to look at it. It's just a couple pages long. It does summarize the main terms and conditions of that plan. In the testimony earlier, the author said that she was interested in trying to prevent up to 30,000 preventable foreclosures in Minnesota. We also included an article from a Minnesota newspaper from the Pioneer Press, where there was testimony from a mortgage expert. You guys all remember Prentice Cox. He said that this Obama plan could prevent up to 200,000 preventable mortgage foreclosures in the state of Minnesota. So almost 10 times what the author of the bill hoped to do with this particular piece of legislation. We included that article in your packet as well. The second thing that we're working on with the author is some of the timing issues that are in the bill. Unreasonable delay in the foreclosure process is not a good thing. We need to get to the bottom of this current cycle in order to turn the corner and start improving our housing situation. Unreasonable delays will not help us get through that. The third piece of information that we put in your packet was a timeline that we've put together on the foreclosure process. It does take into account the counseling that that was adopted by the legislature, something that we very much supported last year. As far as narrowing the scope of this bill, we hope that you would consider the fact that all the testimony about the need for this bill has been about out-of-state people who are difficult to contact, securitization pools, and servicers who are located outside the state. The problem is clearly identified. Those are the people that we're trying to get to the table. And as the legislature, it is your job to craft a solution that addresses that problem, and in our opinion, without imposing additional costs on our financial system. Minnesota lenders are not the problem, that yet they do get swept into this bill. Think about who you would want to deal with. Do you want to deal with your local banker, or do you want to deal with 1-800-SERVICER? You see your local banker at the local restaurants. You see them at the local high school hockey games. You see them at church. You have access to that person. It's that the issue that we're dealing with here today is trying to bring that type of access to the rest of the world. And we know that our bankers work with their people. I was talking with one of my bankers who told me a story when last year when one of their local plants was shutting down. The plant had indicated they'd be shutting down for 6 months or at the worst for 9 months. That banker proactively contacted every single borrower that he had who worked at that plant, and they came out with a workout plan. Whether it was deferring payments, whether it was trying to get them to do interest-only payments or something like that, the banker didn't wait for them till they were 90 days late to work on that problem. The banker proactively went out and took care of that problem himself. Another banker was telling me about a situation where a woman lost her job, and they were able to identify that problem early on. What they did in that situation is they worked out an interest-only plan that took into account her specific amount of unemployment that she was going to receive, and he was able to keep her in her house. There are a few technical issues that we'd like you to also think about as you look at this bill, and we appreciate that the author wants to coordinate this bill with the counseling. When it was originally drafted, we saw that as a major concern, that it sort of ignored the new counseling provisions, and we do appreciate, again, that the author would like to work to make the counseling and the mediation work together. Second thing is with respect to some of the bad faith requirements that are in the bill. This is another thing that we want to work with the author on. The remedies are a little bit one-sided in our opinion. If the borrower if the lender acts in bad faith under this bill, the borrower gets to have all their court costs and attorney's fees paid. If the borrower acts in bad faith, the lender gets to go to foreclosure, which is a right that they already have under the documents and under our current statutes. It's not fair that the only remedy is something that you're already entitled to. Also, with respect to the timing, we would like to shorten up the time frames to, again, make sure that unreasonable delays don't further clog our system. As the Commerce Committee, I think you guys have a big charge to balance the costs and the benefits of legislation like this. You have to balance the benefits and weigh those, but you also have to look at the costs. In this situation, do you believe that there is going to be additional benefits to having the Minnesota financial institutions covered by this particular bill? If they're not the problem you're trying to address, why are they included in it? I would question whether costs like additional training that will be needed by the banks, rewriting policies and procedures, rewriting forms, either paper format or with the lender's software companies, those are all real costs that will come as a result of this bill. And I guess the question is, do you want our financial institutions that are already doing a good job with this to spend their money on those types of things, or do you want them to increase capital like the last bill that you were just talking about? We need lending in order to get out of this economic cycle, and our financial institutions can either spend their money on these types of costs, or they can get out and lend in their communities. With that, I'd be willing to stand for any questions that you have, but I thank you for your time and for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Witt. We appreciate your time and your comments. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Mara Humphrey. I'm the Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Credit Union Network. And I'm here today to put some credit unions' concerns with this legislation on the record. Credit unions view foreclosure as really a measure of last resort, and they have been working with their members any way that they can. I've been calling some of our members, talking to them, seeing what they're doing. It's amazing. Everyone knows what is going on with the mortgages. You ask them, they can list the seven that have come delinquent because everyone in the credit union has been working on it. And I'm proud to say that credit unions were really out in front. We've been out in front working with members if they look like they may become delinquent to see what we can do. We've done everything from, with workout proposals that reduce the payments, reduce the interest, reduce the principal. Gone so far as I know one credit union said that they were offering, $200 a month just to keep the loan going. Someone had lost a job. So going above and beyond what's even in the new federal Obama plan, I'm proud to say that we have been at the table. We are happy to work with members. One thing about credit unions is that they hold the majority of the loans that they originate on their books. So they're very vested in making sure that, they're not in just a servicing agreement. They want to make sure that, they can keep that homeowner in the house. As everyone knows, foreclosure is very expensive. If there's a way to avoid it, we are trying very hard to do this. I appreciate Representative Hillstrom's willingness to work with us, to look at the timeline, to look at some of our concerns. Frankly, one of our biggest concerns is timeline. Looking at this legislation, it would add up to 100 days to the foreclosure process. And we're concerned anytime you add time to the foreclosure timeline, it adds the additional risk that the house is going to be in worse shape, it's going to be worth less, it is going to be a blight, it is going to be an eyesore in the community. And we're really concerned that adding any additional time to the foreclosure process, which Minnesota already has one of the longest foreclosure processes in the state, is going to have on the process and in communities in general. We supported the counseling provision like many others did last session. I think it is working well. I know some credit unions even have contracted with their own counseling groups to make sure that we have members who are getting in, not just looking at the mortgage, but looking at their overall financial health. If they're looking like they may be going to foreclosure, I think it's a good thing that they get the financial checkup and examine everything that's going on in their finances right then. So just want to second what has already been said. Credit unions, I believe, have a strong record of coming to the table. We're willing to work with members. I don't think that this legislation was intended to target us. I don't think we are the problem, but concerned that we are getting dragged into this as part of the legislation. So thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Humphrey. And are there any questions for this group of testifiers? Actually, I've got... Was that Representative Hoppe written on your page here, though? Well, Zellers is written over here, so I guess we'll go to Representative Zellers, then Hoppe, then David. Questions for these folks
actually,
or commentary?
Well, no. Actually, Mr. Charlotte, Representative Hoppe goes. Since his kids are watching my kids upstairs,
Representative Hoppe.
Totally defer.
scary in and of itself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've got a question. I don't know who the right person to ask this, but when we look at the article from the Pioneer Press, it says in here that 150 to 200,000 homeowners in the state could benefit. I know we talked about 30,000 homeowners could benefit. I'm wondering, just for my own edification and maybe others on the committee, how many homeowners ballpark in the state are we talking about? Does anyone have that idea? I mean, total. I mean, if we got 150 to 200,000 that this could benefit, do we just have a rough idea?
Is there anybody that can address
total
that?
Homeowners.
You see Mr. Witt pulling up closer to the microphone. Mr. Witt.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I have some data in my briefcase that I'll double check, but I believe that the Mortgage Bankers Association of America reports about 900,000 mortgages in the state of Minnesota, and I will double check that before we leave this topic.
Well, Steve Johnson was nodding over there, so I think you hit the number right on the head.
Okay.
Representative Hoppe?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to add, when we look at this on the front page, it says that 1 in 7 homeowners, or 14.6, are underwater, and then on the back it says that 5% of mortgage loans in Minnesota were at least 30 days late. I don't know what that means. I just thought I'd throw out there for everybody to think about.
Thank you, Representative Hoppe. Representative Zellers, are you comfortable going now?
I am, Mr. Well, we'll see if anybody comes running in the door screaming. The part, and then for any of the testifiers up there, the two concerns I have is we passed 7 or 8 bills, Representative Mullery, Representative Dabney, and a few others have passed these. The, you know, some of the counseling, some of the helping, I mean, besides the industry, but what government part of it was going to be. You all commented on it, but I'd like some specific. Is this going to be an either or if we pass the bill as is? Is it either going to be mediation, or if we pass mediation, it will be counseling? And maybe the officer's going to come back for
Representative Elstrom?
I would hate to waste Representative Dabney's good work.
Mr. Chair and members, that depends on which bill you actually look at, to be frank. The Senate bill is different than the House bill is currently, but they're going to work hand in hand. The goal is to have people benefit from counseling or mediation, or in some cases both. For example, if the person requests mediation, the way it will work is the bankers will send out a notice saying, you know, we're foreclosing and you're entitled to request mediation. And so then the homeowner would request mediation. And if they go to mediation first, we would recommend to them that they seek out the assistance of the counselor to get their items in order. If they go to counseling first, in the Senate it started off, they wanted that to be a screen. We in the House don't like that, and so that has been tweaked as well. But that's why we're working on it, just because there is some debate about how that should fit together.
Representative Zellers?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then to either Mr. Skilbright or Mr. Witt, the looking through the, you know, your side of bad faith, there's a lot of lines. The actual debtor's bad faith or good faith, lack of good faith, is 3 lines. I'd just like a little bit of a comment on that as far as, you know, you have to meet a pretty high standard. There's a lot of things that you're liable for if you don't. The debtor can, what I'm most concerned about is people are going to stay in the house, live for free, say they're going in, you know, in good faith acting through the mediation process. What is there in here that gives you comfort that you're just going to be given a house away for 100 days, I guess it is.
And actually, on that point with respect to the homeowner, the debtor,
right.
If their bad faith is so bad, I mean, if they're lying to you, if they're committing fraud and so forth, I assume there's still civil and, shoot, there's criminal penalties for that. But that's not said, that's already on the books, right? And I'll let you, if they outright lie to you, if they commit fraud, if their bad faith is so extreme, they can actually go to jail for that. That you're not changing that, Representative Elstrom, and I'm just kind of... Okay, and Mr. Witt, you want to respond to Representative Zellers and my concern?
Mr. Chair and Representative, the comment that I made earlier was with respect to this bill and the specific bad lack of good faith or bad faith negotiations that would go on, and I think you are right. If the only remedy for the lender, if the borrower acts in bad faith in the bill, is that you get to go to foreclosure, which is already your legal right, I would just question whether it's balanced. Again, if the lender acts in bad faith during the mediation, then the lender is required to pay for all the borrower's court costs and attorney's fees. I don't know if that's the correct remedy, but it just seems like it is a little one-sided. If the only thing you get is you get to proceed with something that you already had a legal right to do. And, Mr. Chair, I would love to chat with you about all the other remedies that you think would be available in that situation. I don't. Is that through mediation generally, or where would you see some of those other remedies?
I guess the chair will now recognize himself. Actually, Mr. Witt, what I'd suggest that you do is visit with Representative Hillstrom and Mr. Frickley about there's a number of remedies that are currently available in any transactional process. Both civil and criminal penalties, depending on how bad the so-called bad faith, and we try not to even use those words around here anymore. I think you'd be better off hearing from the AG's office and from Representative Hillstrom, and then you can decide whether or not those are truly reasonable remedies for you or not. But actually, Representative Zellers has the floor yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And maybe Mr. Stilbright, in looking under, again, not what's on the books in law now, but under what we're looking at in here, and I don't want you to play a crook, but if you were going to game the system under this, it looks like it's pretty easy to keep going to mediation for 100 days, playing the role and living in the house for 3 months for free, then going into the foreclosure process. And maybe I just need to ask it that bluntly.
Mr. Skilbred?
Mr. Chair and Representative Zellers, I think as Ms. Humphrey indicated, there's a certainty that there's a 100-day extension on the front end. Now, we may work that out down the road, but the way it's drafted, my understanding is you can't go to foreclosure until you offer the mediation, and there's probably about 100 days there that you have to provide for the mediation services. So right now we have a 12 to 14-month period. Now you're going to add 100 days on the front end to offer the mediation. And then getting back to your question regarding bad faith, if you look on page 7, subdivision 3, I know that none of my guys are going to be in the bad faith category, Mr. Chair and members, but if anybody is, there's the potential of 2 extensions each for 180 days on top of that. So you've got a potential 1-year extension on that, which hopefully if you're negotiating in bad faith, you deserve, but you've got a 12 to 14 month process plus another 12 month process potentially.
Thank you, Mr.
Good or bad?
Representative Zellers, Representative David.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to the author of the bill, and then a couple questions for the other witnesses. I heard from several of the testifiers that they're working with you. For to have some change, when will these changes be made?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Davis, I have said to everyone that I've been working with that I am happy to look at any language they're prepared to present to me and we can work on and negotiate. They have not yet brought me any language, so I'm open for some of those discussions and we continue to have the discussions. They did amend the bill in the Senate. It just isn't to my liking yet, so we're still discussing what it is that we can do to do so.
Okay, and
Representative Davis,
back to the if not possible. If it's not, I mean, you look at this chart, the foreclosure process, and I mean, it goes out 30 days, 60, 90, 120, 150, 180, 210, 240, 420. Why not make it a decade? I mean, if they're 240
proposed
days,
amendment, Representative Davis, do you want to? I don't think the bankers would like that, Representative Davis, but if you're proposing that.
But I mean, this gets to the point it's very concerning because what I'm concerned about, and maybe Mr. Witt or Stilbred or Humphrey could help me out with this one. Two questions here. I feel that voting for this bill dries up credit to some extent. Now, as lenders, do you feel raise the credit scores for people that could probably handle it, but now that credit's going to be dried up because we've got to go with these other folks a minimum of 100 days more? So Mr. Witt, maybe?
Mr. Chair.
Well, Mr. Witt's not even leading forward. Why don't we... Representative Hillstrom has a comment, then either Ms. Humphrey, Mr. Stilbred, or Mr. Witt.
Representative Hillstrom. We can throw out all sorts of days. I would really like Mr. Crixby with the Attorney General's office to actually talk through the provisions of the number of days so that folks know. And as people come up here and talk, they are all talking about what they already do. They are already talking about what great service they give to their customers and their constituents. And surely if they're working things out with these folks, they're not going to request mediation. People, not everybody has to go to mediation. Only if you are not getting the response that you feel you need from your banker, you request mediation. So if people are calling up saying, we want to work it out, those homeowners aren't going to say, man, I have to go to mediation because they're foreclosing on my house. What we're finding is that folks are coming forward and saying that some of the bankers are not even talking to them until they're 3 or 4 months behind.
Mr. Chair.
Relax. I know she's not quite answering your question.
Well,
but
get her
and she's getting there, Representative.
I really don't care to hear from her right now, and I certainly don't care to hear from the Attorney General, because I can read this right here. My question to the other folks testifying, I'm not sure where we're going with that, but Mr. Witt, Skilbred, or Humphreys, do you believe that the credit score would have to go up if this bill became law as written?
And, Mr. Witt, I'm going to recognize you. I'll come back to Mr. Frickley to see if he's got a comment with respect to that issue as well. Mr. Witt?
Mr. Chair and Representative, the lending community analyzes all issues, and the price of credit, the availability of credit, is based on lots of factors. Some of them are individual to the borrower. Some of the issues that go to cost and availability of credit is based on risks associated with lending in a certain area. It is entirely possible that lenders would assess the legal and other issues that go into lending in a state like Minnesota when making decisions about credit availability. I cannot say that this will add, you know, a certain percent to the cost or would require higher credit scores in order to make credit available. But it is certainly true that because lending is a risk-based endeavor, that and because one of the risks that you look at is the legal environment, it is entirely possible that lenders would take this into account when making credit decisions.
So not just
Representative David.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to Mr. Witt. So other than possibly drying up credit to some extent, it could also raise interest rates because there's going to be more costs here. So we have the people that are not making their payments for whatever reason. They're not making their payments, and so they're going to have the effect of raising interest rates and possibly drying up credit for people that could pay their home mortgages.
Thank you, Representative David. That didn't sound like a question. It was more sounding like a comment.
I think that's the effect
that
this bill has.
Okay.
And if I'm incorrect, somebody could certainly let me know.
Once we get all the testimony, I do want to, there's a gentleman that asked a statement be read into the record. We indicated to him that we are happy to take his comments and we'll distribute his typed comments. It's from Mr. John Ostfield. And we'll have the special assistance to the Commerce Committee distribute that to members to make sure that you have Mr. Ostfield's comments. Are there other questions for members? Otherwise, I'm going to kind of go to the wrap-up, and then we'll... Representative Zeller?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to the author, there were a couple of questions we asked you in division that, no offense to the three nice people that you're negotiating with at the table, but there were some questions that we had in division you said you were going to work on as we were going forward. Number one was the days, the math. I don't think it was just, you know, my side of the aisle. I think there were a number of us in the committee that represent Solberg, represent Simon, trying to figure out these days, because looking at the bill, again, and if it was just my math, I'd probably say it's okay for you to trust, because that would be in question. But this has become a bigger problem now. And then the... you know, why you picked the Attorney General, and if you had gone to the mediation board or, you know, who else, and I, you know, originally in the hearing you said it was just because they offered first, but I don't think you sought out the mediation board either, and I'm just curious if those two things that we had talked about before were, you'd address those, because I don't think that had anything to do with the three nice folks at the table with you.
Representative Hilton?
I think Representative Simon seems like he wants to say something first, if that would be okay, Mr. Chair. Did you? Yes. Yeah.
What the heck? We apparently are getting answers from those who weren't called on in any event. So Representative Simon, at that point?
You've called on yourself, Mr. Chairman.
So I know, but I actually had an answer to a question. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There was a reference made by Representative Zeller to what went on in Representative Dabney's committee, and we did have a good discussion about the timeline. And it seems to me, and I've talked with some folks who are here in the room behind the scenes about this too, but I have to say, the one thing that I think ought to give some of these folks up here testifying who have trouble with the bill, ought to give them some comfort, is as I read it in line 3.8, section 5 of the bill, really they're in control of when this starts because of the very charitable language that says a creditor desiring to start a mortgage. Wow, I mean, that's a lot of flexibility. They can decide when they are desiring to do it. Doesn't require filing any piece of paper. Doesn't require anything. They must merely desire it in their head. And I'm okay with that. I just think that gives them a lot of flexibility. And I think starting from that point, I'm not saying modifications couldn't be made here, and I've talked with some of the folks who are here in the committee, and I know that Representative Hillstrom awaits language from them, and I'm glad that she's being flexible as well. But it seems to me, to recap what was said in the earlier hearing in front of Representative Dabney's committee, that's at least where I start. As I'm refreshing my memory to our about our discussion, that desiring to start a mortgage, that seems pretty flexible to me. And so that ought to give some extra comfort, I think.
And Representative Hillstrom, the question is actually directed to you. Do you agree with what Representative Simon indicated?
Absolutely, and that is the same testimony Representative Simon gave during the last committee as well, Mr. Chair. That's why I wanted to...
Well, and quite frankly, folks, that's why I'm about to sort of wrap things up. The point of having a division is to take most of the testimony, have most of the issues raised at that division level. And it's my understanding that that this worked its way through, at least I thought it did. Perhaps not.
It went to the division.
It did go through the division. I was, all right, so I see the committee report. So my point is the same, as I think we've had a pretty healthy discussion. We've certainly heard a good amount in favor and in opposition of the bill. I've got a couple folks, actually. Representative Zeller still has the floor. We've got Representative Mullery and Dabney for brief comments on our side, or the right side, and we'll take those and then wrap up the bill. Representative Zeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the other question I had to the author of the bill was about going to the mediation board, asking them to start this process, or that they would be the one that would do this rather than the Attorney General's office. And I didn't know, you know, that was it. So if you'd gotten to that part of the bill yet, or if you hadn't done anything on that since we've from division to here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There has been some discussion about that. However, when we first started with this idea, we started with a press conference announcing the idea, asking folks to come forward with ideas, and all we got were phone calls saying, we don't want to do it, we don't want to do it, we don't want to do it. The Attorney General's office stepped up and said that they would do it, and so that is the process that we've been going with.
Thank you, Representative Ellis.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to your point, I do think that the committee process is where we're going to do this. But the author in that subcommittee promised us that between that committee and this committee, and if I'm mistaken, there's lots of folks who were in that room that were here, said that she would take into consideration some of the things that we had brought up in a bipartisan manner and would change the bill. Now, whether or not the folks who are opposed to her bill come and offer her solutions or their fixes, I don't think that was the point. The point was that she was going to work on the bill in the interim between the two committees and come up and have some changes. We haven't seen any changes since then, so although I appreciate your latitude on how much we've spent on this bill, Mr. Chairman, if it doesn't change from here to the House floor, or I don't know if it has several other stops along the way, you know, this is not what we were discussing in the subdivision, and it's not what happened between the two.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We did all meet as the banking community did meet with both the House and the Senate author, and we did throw out some ideas of some other potential places. We did talk about it. At this point, none of those options have come to fruition, or I am not certain how far the Senate has explored those options as well, but we at least did talk about it. There were 10 or so of us in the room, and people threw out ideas. Mm-hmm. So we at least talked.
Representative Mullery?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
There you go again.
and I haven't had a chance to read through this bill.
It's going to your committee next.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Mullery. Representative Dabby.
Is this, and I'm told that something about the AG has the mediators come through recommendations by the AG's office. Is that correct, or
Mr. Crickley?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, no. The way the bill is currently written, the mediators are selected by the or approved by the Attorney General's office, but there's no requirement that they be employees of the Attorney General's office. And as of right now, the parties are still also, as the bill is written, free to select their own mediator. But there's no requirement in the bill that they are employees of the Attorney General's office.
Why?
And that's an excellent issue for the Civil Law Committee. But Representative Mullery?
I just would love to be that when I was representing somebody that I could pick the person who the judge was going to appoint as the magistrate. But
although this is, let's remember, Representative Mullery, this is a mediator. They're not the arbitrator.
No,
they're not the decision.
Very aware of that.
And in most mediations, each party picks their agrees to a mediator in any event.
I'm sure
that would be the whole
mediation. how it ever it can have an effect. Who is?
I just want to make sure, though, that we're not that folks that may not be familiar with mediation understand that it's a neutral.
But that's why if a side can pick the neutral. I'd also heard that there was something in here about if they reach a modification. That absolves from immunity to the investors in some way. Is that in here or not? No?
Mr. Frickley?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, the immunity provision in the bill is for the mediator.
Oh, okay. And then
Representative Mullery?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And has the Bar Association been involved with this? Or
Mr. Frickley?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, the Bar Association as a whole has not commented on the bill that I'm aware of. The Real Property Council has some concerns that they have raised with the authors, and I know that the authors are working through those with the Real Property Council.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Dabby.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Davids, your comments brought back to memory a bill that I had last year that was similar in some respects. And folks argued that if it went into law, that credit would be harder to get, interest rates would go up. My favorite was the guy from the American Securitization Association, I think it was, Forum, thank you, who said, you know, my gosh, if this Dabney bill becomes law, people won't be able to tell what the value is of mortgage-backed securities on the stock market. And the general point made by opponents of the bill was that the world would come to an end financially if the Dabney bill passed. It did. Representative Tower is right. The Dabney bill passed this body a snug but comfortable margin, bipartisanly passed the Senate, was vetoed by the governor, and still credit dried up, interest rates are a mess, and nobody knows what the value is of mortgage-backed securities.
So just introducing the bill, Representative Dabney.
You don't really,
Representative David.
I rest my case.
The mere introduction of the bill.
Mr. Chairman,
Dabney. Oh, what? I think he knows that. He just told us that. Folks, thank you all very much for your comments and thoughtful questions. Representative Dabney renews his motion. I'm just looking for the file number.
354.
Representative Dabney renews his motion that House File 354 be reckoned and passed and re-referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. We appreciate the author's assurances on the issues that she intends to work on. We wish you luck in the Civil Justice Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Next up, thank you, by the way, to everybody that came and testified. House File 239, Representative Dabney will move that the committee report on House File 239 be adopted. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Representative Dabney will then move that House File 239 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. Representative Gardner, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
My understanding there is an author's amendment.
That is correct. First, I want to thank you for rescuing me from a discussion about debate in the Environment Committee.
We try to take care of people like that, Representative Gardner. Okay. Representative Dabney will move the A2 amendment to put the bill in the shape with which the author would like to proceed. All in favor? The chair will move that, how, that the A2 amendment be adopted. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, Representative Gardner, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 239 was heard in Representative Dabney's division. This bill would add one more thing that homeowners could essentially file suit for in case of a warranty breach situation. There are currently some limits that you see in your bill in 327A.05, and I'm adding a third one, which is reasonable cost for short-term housing, and then the meals and incidental expenses is now crossed out because of the author's amendment. And I've essentially linked that short-term housing cost to a per diem rate that is set by the U.S. General Services Administration. If you ever travel either on federal dollars or as a federal employee, they figure out what the per diem rate is for that, and that's the maximum you can get for lodging, meals, and incidental expenses. I've crossed out the meals and incidental expenses as a second overture to the builders to demonstrate my willingness to come to an agreement on this bill. All my testifiers are in the Senate, I'm afraid, Mr. Chair, because all the homeowner bills are being heard at this time. I don't know if you really want any more detail at this point. Or
A bit of clarity, Representative Gardner. What we're talking about here is people that really can't live in their house when they've got a homeowner's, they've got some claim that they're making. They don't, it's not just some stain on their carpet where they could still remain in their house. This is where it's unlivable or very difficult to live in their home, and they have to go and get a hotel room for a couple of days. Is that where we're...
That is correct, Mr. Chair. Comment from the builders has been that that could be an arbitrary choice, that if you did have a stain in the carpet, you could take a hike out of your house. But I don't really know anybody who would really want to do that. Nobody really wants to be out of their house, and we could come up with 10 pages.
Oh, there's days.
Mr. Chairman, I...
Yeah, you got the Hoppy kids and the Zellers kids upstairs, and they won't even let them down here.
Oh,
but
I'll bring my Gardner kids next week. Spring break. I also did have a handout that should be in your packet that just shows the web page from the General Services Administration website. It actually circles the lodging column, which shows the maximum allowed, and the bill actually specifies that you can't use the per diem other than the area in which your property is located. So you couldn't be in, say, Mora and then decide you're going to stay at the Marquette in downtown Minneapolis, for example. And if you're not on this list, there is a non-standard rate, which is a maximum of $70. Okay. Mr. Chair, that's...
thank you, Representative Gardner. I believe we've got one or two folks that would like to testify, and then we'll take whatever questions that people have. I've got Ms. Weaver on the... on the list. Welcome back.
Mr. Chairman, real quick.
Representative Zellers.
Mr. Chairman, real quick, thank you, and not to the author of the bill or testifiers, and raise the same concern I raised in Representative Dabney's committee. We've got 7A bills all in the same section here in 327A. We had 1, 5, 3, and I think 7 in the subdivision. As I understand it, all the folks in this industry and this group are going to get together and have a kumbaya bill at the end. And rather than putting the committee through 15 of these different bills, I would really appreciate if you could put them all into one and be done with it at the end or the beginning of the end of the session. But again, no offense to the author, but we've seen four or five different bills in the same section, and they're going to keep coming up. And as they all got together, I thought we were to that point yet, but apparently not. Just renew my slight objection, I guess, Mr. Chairman, to hearing all these bills when eventually they're just going to get smashed into one pizza at the end. But
thank you, Representative Deli.
For the committee,
to their credit, both to the builders and to the authors, the various authors of the bills, and even co-authors. I know Representative Simon was there as well. There was a meeting last week, Thursday morning, to go through a number of the bills. There's some that are progressing. There's others that are not quite progressing. There was a good, I think, healthy discussion of the various issues, born out of which are some changes that some of the authors are making to their bills. And I really give both parties a lot of credit for being willing to sit down and work through. And it was a very cogent, thoughtful discussion, and I'm not certain if there is going to be one big pizza at the end or not. That would assume that all these bills make it through the division, make it through the committee, and I don't, quite honestly, I don't know if that's going to happen or not at this point. But with that, Representative Weaver, I don't know if that's a promotion or demotion, but Ms. Weaver, your testimony.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Members of the committee, thanks for having me. I did learn a good piece of news today, sitting through the last bill. If there's 1.1 million homes and 900,000 mortgages, that means 200,000 homeowners have paid off their mortgages. I think that's great news. So, I'm not one of them, but I think that's good news. I appreciate Representative Gardner's ability changes on this bill. I really, really appreciate it, and we have had some good conversations. I still share concerns that the judge, number one, already has the ability to provide and require the builder or the builder's insurance company to pay for housing if they so choose. I've sat in three mediations on these types of bills where in a mediation session the mediator has said, you're going to pay for the housing because it is so egregious. I think that within the confines of a negotiation between a homeowner and a builder and the insurance company and a mediator, they can already do this. But putting it in statute provides more trouble for our industry and less specificity. So I appreciate the change, but we have to respectfully not support the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Weaver. We appreciate your comments. I should ask, is there anyone else who desires to be heard with respect to this bill? Other than members at this point, is there any other testimony? All right, Representative Mullery, and then I saw a hand over here as well. But Representative Mullery?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Weaver, I was trying to get at exactly what you were saying. Are you saying that under 327A the judge can do that, or under the standard homeowner's warranty form?
Ms. Weaver?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, 327A is the warranty. Typically,
right.
When a builder is sued for some type of breach of warranty, there are three kind of. I'm not a lawyer, so there are three ways that a lawyer or a builder is sued. One is warranty. Second is breach of contract, and third is negligence. So, typically, warranty is never alone. Breach of contract and negligence are always part of that claim. And a lot of these cases don't go to trial. They are mediated. That's why we don't see a lot of judgments in these cases. And I have had the opportunity to sit through three mediations, and in some cases the house is so damaged that the homeowner does need to move out, and the mediator has awarded, I guess, the ability for the builder, required the builder to pay. That's been part of the negotiation. So they already can do this.
Representative Mueller?
Mr. Chair, I think what you're saying is what I thought it was, is that it's not under 327A, so what we're doing is putting it under 327A also, so that it's not just under the breach of contract or the homeowner's standard warranty form.
I think that's what the waiver.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mueller, I understand. Thank you.
Are there other questions or comments from members of the committee? Seeing none, Representative Dabney will withdraw his motion with respect to House File 239. The chair will make the motion that House File 239, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
The motion prevails. Thank you all very much. With that, a little bit, I see Representative Zellers and Hoppe have run off to the kids, but a little bit of a roadmap. We're starting to get closer to deadlines, so you'll see that the committee agendas will start to beef up a little bit in the next couple of weeks. We'll do our best to move through those rapidly. We'll also do our best to get out the list of agenda items to you with as much notice as we possibly can, even more than 3 days if we can. But I'll just forewarn you that some of the bills that are popping to us from other committees, obviously there might only be a chance to get out a day or two notice. We'll do our best to get it to you so that you have a chance to prepare. With that, we stand adjourned.